Presented by T-Mobile, the official wireless partner of Odyssey Sports. With an awesome network and great savings, there's never been a better time to join T-Mobile. Visit your neighborhood store to make the switch today.
Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Ravens break the huddle. First down at the Texans' 45-yard line. Jackson to throw. Now under pressure, and Watt brings him down. J.J. with a sack.
J.J. Watt, two sacks on Sunday, two TFLs, three quarterback hits, a lot of crooked numbers. That was good to see in the box score from J.J. Watt. The number that jumped out at me, though, Seth, was, and I noticed this during the game, there were a lot of times I looked down on the field and I said, huh, J.J.'s not out there. And even on some passing downs, yeah. J.J. Watt's not out there. That's strange. I'd look over at the sideline, I go, there he is. He's standing there with his helmet on right next to Anthony Weaver. And thought to myself, I can't wait to see what his snap count is for this game, because it felt like he played less than he normally does. He was still out there quite a bit, and especially because he played 100% of the snaps in week one. So I think just intuitively, it's not like he came into the season on a pitch count, because he didn't do anything in the preseason, right? He didn't do any 11-on-11. He barely put pads on in the preseason this year. And if he were on any sort of load management, you would think that a game against Kansas City, where they were trailing by three touchdowns for most of that game, that he would have played 60% of the snaps in that game. He played every single snap in that game. He played 68% of the snaps on Sunday, and that was a game that was competitive for a much longer period of time than the Kansas City game was. Unless there's something wrong with J.J., what would be the reason for that, do you think?
I think that this isn't anything new in the NFL, what I'm about to explain. The rotating of defensive linemen, they've known this for a long time. And it's really ever since linemen started getting much, much bigger, people started realizing, man, guys are better when you can rotate them in and out. Like the endurance just isn't the same. And you always have that, you have that risk reward, though, of, okay, how good are my backup defensive linemen? Because if J.J. Watt's my best defensive lineman, and he's at his best when he only plays like 70% of the snaps, so he can be extremely fresh. Well, okay, that's good as long as whoever's coming in for him is holding up their end of the bargain and they're pretty good. And so you got to say, okay, what's best for the team versus what's best for individual production, or is individual production best for the team? You got to find this nice balance. And then you also have kind of that pride aspect of it, that a lot of guys, genuine studs like J.J., they just don't want to be off the field. You know, they feel that the best chance for the team to produce is when he's on the field. And I would say, and I've been saying this for a while with J.J., or really any dominant pass rusher, you're going to get the absolute most out of those guys the more times you can avoid them being on the field for 10 straight plays or being on the field. It's almost not, it's not even like total snaps in the game. It's how many times do they really get like worn down in a game? Because your legs don't really recover from that genuinely. By the fourth quarter, if you have two or three long drives, you're not going to be as sharp. So I think really for J.J., especially at this age and with his injury history, him rotating in and getting three quarters of the snap or two thirds of the snap, I think he's going to be the most impactful and have the most behind the line of scrimmage plays if he does it that way. And I think now, because of Jacob Martin, because of some of these guys on the interior as they start to develop, maybe they feel better about some of these other guys being able to contribute when JJ's on the sideline.
Okay, so let's say JJ plays 100% of the snaps in week one. And let's say that game for him was a 6.5 on a scale of 1 to 10. He plays 68% of the snaps in week two, but while he was in there, he was closer to probably an 8.5 or a 9.
Right.
And so that, just in a vacuum, you go, well, I'd rather have the 8.5 or a 9 for 30% fewer plays, just in a vacuum. What I'm hearing from you is that this defense, the drop-off from J.J. to whoever the next guy is, and I know it's not as simple as the next defensive end, there's different packages and things like that.
Yeah.
But what I'm hearing you say is that this defense is better off with J.J. being a 9 for 70% of the game than a 6.5 for 100% of the game, given what is in there replacing him.
Yeah, because I think that like the older I get and the more I watch football, as I try to figure out like which beliefs of mine are probably wrong and I need to let go of, I think that I almost don't care anymore at all about how many yards a team gives up. Like I almost don't care how many field goals they give up. Like I care
it's
about
touchdowns.
I care about how many times can you end a drive. Like I think about a football game in terms of number of drives and what happens on those drives. And if you've got 12 plays or 12 drives that you have to defend in a game, and you can end three of those drives with a sack that not only stops the drive but also hurts field position, then I think that's a bigger win than, yeah, being out there to where, like, hey, we did a better job versus the run, and they just say, it's like, how many big plays can you make in the backfield? In the like, how can you maximize J.J. Watt? It's doing whatever it takes to get the most big plays in the backfield.
This is where some of it is on the Texans' offense, and especially against good teams, and here's where I'm going with this, Seth. Yeah, most 12 drives is normally the number in your average NFL game. In a game that involves the Baltimore Ravens that run the football all the time, that number probably shrinks to 9 or 10 drives in a game, right? You know, unless the game gets out of hand and then the numbers get skewed. But in a game that would normally be closely contested with the Ravens, it'd probably be 9 or 10 drives. Lopez said this on their show yesterday, and I'm thinking, well, that sounds a little strange. That sounds a little odd. But the more I thought about the math of a game against the Ravens, you're absolutely right, which is, against the Ravens, you'd probably take them kicking a field goal on every drive. When you think about it, and you go, okay, well, that's 27 points or 30 points. Maybe you get off the field on one of them, like you said. You get a sack on third down. Boy, they have to punt. Or, God forbid, the Texans force a turnover. But if they're kicking field goals on practically every drive, let's say, you go, okay, well, I mean, look, 24, 27 points given up is not optimal, but it is the Ravens, and that's when the Texans off it. That's when you go, okay, we can be a bend but don't break defense where we are giving up points on a lot of the drives if we feel like our offense can be competent against these guys. And the Texans' offense is incompetent right now.
You just paid a quarterback $40 million a year.
Right.
There's a part of the team building there where O'Brien, look, I think O'Brien's plan had to have at least been a little bit, all right, yeah, we're not spending on defense in the offseason except on Eric Murray and whomever else, but because we feel like we can hold up well enough and our offense will hold up their end, which is going to be like we'll be a better offense than we will be on defense.
Yep.
I think that's the only reason, that's the only acceptable rationale for just completely doing nothing to your defense for the most part, almost
yes,
doing nothing to improve your defense. So
yep,
you can agree or disagree with that. Right now it's not working out because the offense isn't holding up its end of the bargain.
That's right, 100% right.
Sean, I'll tell you the part I always think about this. I think it was the perfect example of like old school mentality about defense versus the last 30 years where defensive linemen have been rotating in a lot more was in the Rams when they won their Super Bowl with Dick Vermeil. That was Kevin Carter's third season in the NFL, maybe, the defensive end for the Rams. And I remember it was on a key drive late in the game. They had Vermeil mic'd up, and Kevin Carter came out of the game and was on the sideline. And Vermeil looked at him, and he was like, "What the hell are you doing? It's the last drive of the game. You're not going to be out there." And it was like, it was a long drive. And it's just, no, that's what you do. You rotate them out. It's like a hockey rotation.
Yeah.
And it just works better. Like, hockey players are the toughest athletes on earth, probably, in some respects, non-martial arts or wrestling-based. And those guys, it's not like those guys go out there and play every minute of a game.
No, their average shift is like 60 seconds long, and then they go sit for 2 or 3 minutes.
You go out and you go like hell as hard and as fast as you can for a few plays, and then you get a blow and then you go back in. And yeah, I think you'd get the most out of JJ doing that.
Yeah.
It's a good, I'm really glad you brought that up, Sean.
Yeah. Yeah, 68% of the time. I'm going to ask him about that today. JJ and Deshaun meet with the media today at 2:00. So I want to know if that was by design or if that was something that they went into the game. You know, was there something they saw him playing 100% of the snaps against Kansas City the week before where they sat him down? Because they probably, Seth, you're probably right. They probably did. If this is something where they go, we think this is best for you, I mean, that's probably like trying to keep like at the rodeo, trying to keep one of those bulls inside the stall right there. You know what I mean? Like, it's not easy to do.
It's James Harden. You know, I think James Harden would be, James Harden, it's hard to say, like, he'd be a lot better, but okay, whatever. Like, I don't want to get into a James Harden debate here. You could say that I think a lot of people feel like you could even further optimize James Harden and maybe have him be stronger in the fourth quarter, and stronger at the end of the season. If not even by, you know, not, don't load manage him by having him sit games, because he's never going to do that, but you don't have to finish, you know, the first quarter every game, or, you know, you don't have to stay out as long or come in as early as you do sometimes in the first half. And that'll save you for the fourth quarter.
Let's look ahead at the next three games. Let's just look at this at a three-game window. At Pittsburgh, home for Minnesota, home for Jacksonville. The next three games, and play the what if with the possible Texan records. What are we saying if their record is ... after five games? Seth and I will break that down for you next. All right, so the Texans' schedule over the next 3 weeks: at Pittsburgh this Sunday at noon, a game you can hear right here on Sports Radio 610. Seth and I on the pregame, Clint and I on the postgame. Get started at 9 a.m. And then two home games in a row that should have fans in the stands at those games: Minnesota and Jacksonville, two games in a row. And it's ironic, Seth, that if you took a look at the schedule before the season and said in weeks 4 and 5, the Texans are going to play Minnesota and Jacksonville in weeks 4 and 5 at home, one of those teams is going to be 0-2 and look like one of the worst teams in the league. The other one's going to be 1-1 and looks very plucky and has a lot of fight to them. I would have said, well, yeah, that's, thanks for describing the Vikings and the Jags, but they're actually the complete opposite of what we thought each would be so far this season. I just think that's kind of funny. Again, small sample size, it's only 2 weeks. But
LaVisca Chenault. I'm going to say LaVisca Chenault once a day, because I know we have at least two listeners that were adamant the Texans needed to find a way to take
him. Get out of Colorado, if I'm not mistaken,
yeah,
right? Wide receiver out of Colorado.
And he's looking promising for the Jaguars.
He is. The Jags are, not to get off on a Jags tangent, they've got a ton of draft picks coming up this year, and they had a ton of draft picks in this past draft. They're going to have a ton of young talent on that football team. They're the opposite of the Texans is what they are. You know, just from purely from a team-building standpoint, the Texans are swapping all these picks out to get expensive veterans. The Jags are accumulating picks, and they're bound to hit on a few of these. You know,
I think the Jaguars are doing the same thing the Dolphins did, which is there's some psychological block where they really want to tank, but they just can't quite bring themselves to do it. And I think just for the sake of not looking like they're tanking, they make a couple of moves that look all right. And like, they signed that linebacker from the Browns.
Schobert.
I can't think of his. Yeah. You know, it was a good player. And then they got rid of all their other good players.
Yeah. Well, you do.
But they're going to be like, just like the Dolphins were last year. You can't tank with Fitzpatrick because he's going to win some games for you.
Minshew.
You can't tank with Gardner Minshew. Minshew is going to win some games for you.
Yep, no doubt. All right, so Seth, the Texans are 0-2 right now. Let's just, to keep this simple, let's just look at the next three games. The Texans, again, play at Pittsburgh, home for Minnesota, home for Jacksonville. What are you and I saying when we come in on the Monday after the Jacksonville game if the Texans have won 3 in a row and now they're 3-2 on the season?
We're going to say Bill O'Brien is the leading candidate for executive of the year. He probably proved all of the old school NFL wrong in the way he conducted himself in the offseason. And I am now a believer in Jack Easterby. I will join his cult. I will offer up all my 401k and everything else I have available. I'll go live in the, you know, in the compound in the desert and worship you three times a day. Yeah.
Now, some of it's nuanced. Some of it, if they win all three of these games. Remember when they won 3 in a row, where they went 0-3 a couple years ago, and then they evened their record out at 3-3? And the talk was, yeah, they're 3-3, but they needed Frank Reich to screw up, they needed Jason Garrett to screw up, and they needed Nathan Peterman to screw up in order to win very, very close. Two of them were overtime games, and the other one was a pick six.
Sean, when you isn't that pretty much the rule? Like, if you're gonna beat Nathan Peterman, it's gonna be because Nathan Peterman makes a mistake. It's not because you beat him.
It is.
I mean, the guy's probably one of the best young quarterbacks we've seen.
Yeah, right. No, it is. And I know you're being tongue in cheek with that, but seriously, like, if they win 3 in a row, does Bill O'Brien get any sort of reprieve from this fan base if they're 3-2 after if they're 3-2 after five games? If you had told somebody before the season this is the first five games and they're going to be 3-2, I think most people would have signed up for that.
Right. Now, I think that you can catch yourself after 0-2 in the minds of the fans and the general public at large and all of that. when you start off 0-3, and this is the way it works in the NFL, even like by people just in looking around the league and watching teams, you kind of write people off psychologically. You don't just do it with your own team. You do it with other teams. That's what happened with the Chargers about every other year, where in your mind, the Chargers will have a rough start, and you'll think, like, okay, the Chargers are dead in the water. And then all of a sudden, at the end of the season, you realize, oh, the Chargers are about to make the playoffs.
Right.
Oh, okay. You just kind of write them off. And I think that's what people did at 0-3. You wrote them off, and then they went on that 8-game win streak?
Nine-game win streak.
And it almost just felt like a whisper. You know, it didn't really garner much attention. So, but at 0-2, yes, and especially if you beat the Steelers after an 0-2 start, then all of a sudden it feels like, all right, you know what? They got it out of their system. Some of the new guys are coming. It would sure help a lot if, Brandon Cooks had a huge game. And Brandon Cooks looked a lot closer to having a huge game last week than he did week one.
Yeah, I think if they win those three games, and especially with the two home games, they win them in a fashion that you feel like they should win those games, then I think I don't think people will be in on O'Brien. People are not going to be in on Bill O'Brien until he gets to an AFC title game. Let's be real about that. Like, fully in on him until he at least gets to an AFC title game. But I think at least the heat will be off on Bill O'Brien a little bit, and it'll feel like, okay, well, and this may not be good enough for some people, but they're a good team that's kind of just taking care of the business they're supposed to take care of. Of the possible outcomes, and Seth and I are going through the what-ifs of the first five games of the year, the next one is probably the toughest one to go, okay, here's what we'll be saying the Monday following the Jacksonville game, because there's so many ways they could get at this record. But what if they're 2-3? Through the first five games? What are the things that would affect what we're saying the Monday after week five?
I think that if they lose the Pittsburgh game and it's not close at all, like if it's like the way the last 2 weeks went, then it's not going to matter.
Beating
the Vikings and beating the Jaguars won't matter. I think that they'll say, okay, well, great, you're beaten. It's like you just said with the previous scenario. It's going to be, and I think fairly so, a lot of people will say, well, it's just more of the same, right? Like the Texans are really good at beating bad teams and other mediocre teams, but there is just a clear and defined glass ceiling when it comes to beating the better teams. And almost in the same way that it's been the last few years where with the Rockets, it's only just been a matter of, all right, let's wait through the regular season until we get to the playoffs, because we don't really know until we get to the playoffs what this team is. It'd be like a more depressing version of that, where you feel like, okay, they're going to make the playoffs, and I'm not optimistic that they're not going to pull another Kansas City in the playoffs.
Yeah.
So here we go. Then the ennui kicks in.
Okay, what if they're 1-4 through the first five games?
I think then there's a very real and good chance that Bill O'Brien gets fired during the bye week. And then I think then the question becomes,
okay, the bye week is week eight. Wow.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. But 1-4, you start – 1-4 is when maybe ownership really starts considering it and thinking, oh, wow, the emails, the voicemails, all of those things from fans, the letters, like actual physical letters show up. Boy, I bet when the physical letters start showing up, that's when owners start getting nervous.
Handwritten notes make a big difference.
Yeah, those, especially these days, an angry physical letter, there's a 50% chance that person's psychotic and potentially.
Yeah, especially if it's one of those letters where the letters are cut out from magazines, you know?
If you take
different
the time
fonts
to sit down and write a physical letter,
yeah, you're angry.
Like, actually remember how to make a cursive Z and
right,
everything.
Right, right.
Oh,
either,
my God.
If you sit down and write a letter, you're either very thankful for something or very angry about something. One of the two. And here's the thing about 1-4, Seth. If they're 1-4, they are 1-4 with a trip to Tennessee and a home game against the Packers coming up the next 2 days. They're 1-4. They're staring at 1-6. You know what I mean? Like, those are two teams that are both 2-0 right now and leading their divisions.
Then the question will be, is Anthony Weaver ready for an interim head coaching job? Who would be the interim head coach if Bill O'Brien were fired? I don't think you can just go with Romeo Crennel. With an interim coach, you want to at least maybe inject some juice. And remember the dude that took over for the Dolphins a few years ago, the former tight end?
Yeah, God, what was his name?
Oh, he's the one that beat the Texans, right?
I know. God, he was such a nut job. Remember, he was like doing Oklahoma drills at practice?
No, what was it?
He was from A&M, I remember.
Yeah, he was a good tight end in the NFL.
I'll find it. You keep doing that thing you do where you talk. I'll keep.
But anyway, yeah, so like.
Dan Campbell.
Okay, all right. Gosh, I had that completely mixed up.
Yeah.
So is Dan Campbell. You don't want Weaver to be that. You want him to be a guy that can actually pull it off as an interim head coach.
Yeah.
But it just so rarely works out that your interim head coach ends up taking over and is successful. There's a really poor track record of that. You know, Freddie Kitchens is the latest example of an interim coach taking over and watching it go down in flames. So yeah. I think, I don't know, maybe it might be time for Romeo Crennel to take over as the interim head coach at that point.
Yeah, I think, boy, even if you got to 1-5, 1-6, and they pulled it out of the nosedive and were 8-8 to end the year, do you really feel like you're going anywhere at that point? And you brought up the example during the break, Dan Quinn from Atlanta. You know, they were 1-7 last year to start the year, and they gave him an opportunity to pull it out of a nosedive, and he went 6-2 the second half of the year. And they're like, okay, well, we can't fire him now. He went 6-2 over the second half of the year. And now Atlanta's 0-2 to start the year. They get worked by Seattle in week one, and then they give up a monumental comeback to the Cowboys. It included an onside kick where the entire hands team stared at the football like it was, I said yesterday, like it's a live grenade. Like they just stayed away from it, and the Cowboys recover it. And I would imagine all of Atlanta right now that cares about the Falcons is probably like, why didn't we fire this clown last year?
Dan Campbell, you know what? Dan Campbell and Nick Foles fall into a similar category for me, and it's the unintended mid-season change that ends up being really good for you. And I don't know, so because this is what happened. Everybody knows the Nick Foles mid-season happened. Like, Nick Foles takes over, and there's not really enough time to catch up to Nick Foles' tendencies or anything, and he goes on a miraculous run and wins a Super Bowl. I don't think the Eagles would have won a Super Bowl if Nick Foles had started out the season as the quarterback.
Yeah.
You have that half-season grace period with quarterbacks where they seem to be able to ambush the league. What happened with the Falcons the year they won the Super, or the year they went to the Super Bowl, was that Richard Smith was their defensive coordinator, former Texans defensive coordinator Richard Smith, and he was awful, just an atrocious defensive coordinator. As we knew, somehow Dan Quinn hired him to be the defensive coordinator for the Falcons after knowing exactly what happened here in Houston with Richard Smith. It was absurd. So anyway, Dan Quinn strips play calling from Richard Smith, I think about two-thirds of the way through that season, and all of a sudden, man, the defense took off. Well, yeah, they only had a little bit of a grace period there. You know, Dan Quinn, he'd been a good defensive coordinator in Seattle under Pete Carroll, but that's not the same as doing it on your own.
No.
And all of a sudden, it looks like, oh, wow, yeah, Dan Quinn really looks like he knows what he's doing with the defense. No, so I wish teams would save something like that they plan on pulling out of their backpack in December that completely changes everything.
Yeah.
You know, whether it's a coaching change, a quarterback swap, whatever it might be. Because at least twice I've seen Super Bowl runs that I don't think would have happened if there hadn't been this accidental switch midway through the season.
Text message, I would not be surprised if the interim coach would be Jack Easterby.
Oh, that would be awesome. Oh my god.
I'm here for that.
That would be so much fun.
I'm here for that.
But yeah, no, but what if they did well? I can't eat that much crow.
I'm really here for that. All right. Download the radio.com app. The radio.com rewind feature allows you to, it's a great app. It allows you to rewind to the beginning of the show, bring us with you wherever you go with that radio.com app. John McClain joins us at the top of the hour. He was on In the Loop yesterday, and he was about as specific as he's gotten about what could get Bill O'Brien fired. John usually sloughs that question off. He did not do that yesterday. Well, the audio will address it with John directly at the top of the hour. That's all next. And so John McClain was on In the Loop yesterday for his weekly visit. He joins us at the top of the hour, so we'll revisit this with him. But this was about as specific as I've heard John get, or at least addressing it in relatively long form, the decisions that the McNairs are going to have to make if this season starts to go sideways on the Texans. They're 0-2 to start the season, and the schedule lightens up a little bit, but not very much over the next month or so. Here was John McClain when he was asked by John and Landry yesterday about what happens with Bill O'Brien if the season starts to go sideways.
If he goes 2-14, he will be fired. Okay. Because they fire coaches after they go 2-14. Gary Kubiak was fired after 2-14 season. Dom Capers, 2-14, but I doubt very seriously this team's going 2-14. But people, including the McNair family, have high hopes for this season, and they haven't given up after an 0-2 start. There was a lot of people wanting them giving up after the 0-3 start 2 years ago. if he had a bad record, say 5-11, 6-10, I think the McNairs would take a long look at it. Number one thing they would take a look at, okay, if Bill goes 5-11 or 6-10 and we bring him back again, what does that do to ticket sales, suite sales, sponsorships, and all that? How are the people going to accept it?
Right.
But we're a long way from that.
Like an 8-8, you think it's just nothing to see here?
No, I don't think he'd be fired after an 8-8, no.
Yeah.
I think it had to be a really bad record, and they would not have a rash of injuries like they had in 2017.
So, Seth, that little injury caveat at the end might make people a little bit nervous, too. Like, really, there's going to be caveats if they go 5-11?
You know what, Sean? I'm glad that John mentioned the season ticket holders, all of that. Because, look, I think next year, regardless, the season tickets will be sold out. I think the corporate sponsorships and the suites are kind of it doesn't readily show up when you watch on film, and it's not necessarily as big a part of the attendance stats, but like, how much are you selling these suites and these corporate sponsorships for? That's
money.
A big deal.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's huge revenue for the teams. And I think it's important to remember in making your decisions about your professional football team, it's a professional football team. Its core purpose at the end of the day is to make money. All these teams, I don't want to say they're going to be hurting financially, but they're taking a hit financially. They're taking a big hit financially this year. They're not going to go bankrupt or anything, but I wonder how much of that factors into it, where as much as people want to accuse the Texans at times of being all about just, well, hey, they're making money, they don't care, whatever, like all these arguments that frankly, I don't agree with, but it's out there. If that is the case, and if that's what you believe, then maybe that's the avenue to getting rid of Bill O'Brien, if that's what you want. Is that, look, if you can't sell tickets with Bill O'Brien as the coach and people aren't excited about the team, then sometimes ownership just has to make that. They have to let the fans basically make the decision for them.
Yeah, I think here's what you need to understand. I think if you're the owner of a professional sports team or the owner of any business, but we're talking about the Texans here, is that, Seth, even if the Texans go 11-5 and win a couple playoff games, it's going to be a competitive environment for those corporate dollars come next season. There's a better chance of you retaining those dollars if this is a successful team. And certainly if they get further than they've ever been in the playoffs, then this will probably be a brand that a lot of companies are going to want to get behind and be part of on Sundays, because there's a chance then that the fervor behind this team will be as high as it's ever been. If they're able to pull off a couple wins in the postseason and look like a team that's ascending in doing so. I don't want to get too deep in the weeds on whether or not they can sustain that based on cap figures and draft capital and whatnot. But my point is this, that you could put your hand over the record on the sheet of paper at the end of the year. It doesn't matter what the record is at the end of the year. The corporate world is going to be coming off of, or maybe still be even in the midst of a pandemic when the time comes to make all these decisions next year. It's going to be uber competitive, even if you have a team that people are willing to get behind, let alone a team that people feel like is moving backwards where they don't like the head coach.
When you're figuring out your budget in January, your advertising budget, that's where things get dicey. And look, frankly, there's competition amongst the franchises in town, too, for these advertising dollars and for these corporate sponsorships.
No doubt.
This is where, remember yesterday we talked about how you never want to pray for your competition to get injured. You don't hope that Ben Roethlisberger gets injured before you play him. But if it happened, then okay, we can benefit from that. I wonder if the Texans are watching the Astros and what they're going through right now and thinking a little bit like, okay, but it sucks for them, but this is kind of nice, because for a long time the Astros were the darlings over these last few years. Where, man, if you had to make a decision between putting your money with the Texans or the Astros looks awful enticing.
Well, that's a really good point. I don't know if we're connecting too many dots here, but if you're somebody who's of mind where you're like, man, the Texans just need some pressure on them to make a change with the head coach, and if we are saying that business could be something that drives that, and that's what John McClain just said in that cut, and that's what you and I just outlined, the competitive business environment that we're going to be in with businesses locally here largely struggling more than usual because of coronavirus. Seth, in a weird way, the backsliding of the Rockets and the Astros is not helping the people that want change with the Texans. You know what I mean? It's the Astros are not as formidable a competitor for corporate dollars as they were the Rockets right now, with I think people feeling like there's a ceiling on the Rockets and sort of a malaise with them right now that they just got knocked out of the playoffs in the second round with a whimper, that the competition for those corporate dollars might not be as stiff as it would be if those teams were where they were 2 years ago.
But if there's a Bill O'Brien malaise, then you don't have any advantage over those. I think that what you're thinking would be, I think you should actually be optimistic if you want O'Brien gone, because the Texans can very easily say, all right, well, look, the Astros took one on the chin this year. Nobody knows what the hell's going on with the Rockets. All we have as our problem really is that Bill O'Brien is our coach. Well, I know how to fix that.
Yeah.
You go hire Lincoln Riley or whoever else.
Yeah.
I don't know. Personally, my advice to Lincoln Riley is to stay in Oklahoma for the next 70 years of your life and have 18
Yeah, make $12
campus.
Million a year. Yeah. $15 million by the time he's getting into his advanced age, and have him build a statue for you.
But they also, I don't know, people have said that Lincoln Riley pays attention to the NFL. He's not one of these guys that, you know, sometimes, especially some of the extreme spread college coaches, like, could give two dams about the NFL. Lincoln Riley stays plugged in. I don't know. I wonder if there's a part of him but he wouldn't do that until he won a national
championship. Seth, would you feel better about 2020 Lincoln Riley or 2018 Cliff Kingsbury? 2020 Lincoln Riley, for me, in a second, at least he proved he can win football games.
He puts the
Cliff Kingsbury was a sub 500 coach. Like, the Cardinals hired him, and we don't even know if he's a good head coach. You know, I know he's off to a 2-0 start now, but that can change quickly. Like, Lincoln Riley, at least he's in the playoff every year in college football.
The thing about being a coach on most NFL teams is that you don't have to worry about – in college, you're the GM, you know. In the NFL, unless you're the Texans or you've won a Super Bowl, your head coach is not your GM. Right. The defense – and you hire a good defensive coordinator, but you're not also responsible for recruiting the defensive players. You just let the GM take care of that.
Text message, I'm worried about the rough future created by exhausting resources has already started. That's kind of what I was alluding to, and this brings up the question, Seth, not to get too far ahead of ourselves, but this is the topic we're addressing in this segment, is if there were change, how good a job is this for a new head coach potentially, and how good a job would this be for a new GM? Is it a better job for a new head coach? Is it a better job for a new GM? Is it a good job for either of those?
I think it's a good job. Boy, the GM part is you don't have any draft capital. I think that what you can do, though, is create cap space and make some tough decisions, because there's no loyalty to anybody on this team. I think about, ironically enough, as weird as Gettleman, when Gettleman went into Carolina, he made a lot of tough decisions and got rid of people and cleared up their cap situation and turned them into a Super Bowl contender. And then I don't know what happened to him when he went to the Giants. I think there are a lot of GMs that would look at the Texans position and say, okay, do I have a quarterback? Oh, cool. Baller. And then do I have other good core young players? I do. I can take one on the chin for a year or two and clean up this cap situation. And with a new general manager and a new head coach, people get it. People understand that. So, yeah, I don't think it's as big an obstacle as it looks on paper or it feels, because a new guy comes in and makes a bunch of changes, and there's a new invigoration sometimes that helps overcome any of the negatives that you create while you're doing that. And also, even if it doesn't work out in the first season, that's your grace period.
I think a lot of GMs and coaches would be crawling over themselves to get this job, because and it comes down to the same answer for everything when it comes to what's keeping the Texans' head above water right now: Deshaun. Watson would be enough for a general manager to say, yeah, I'm going to come in and I'm going to do an oil spill cleanup of the salary cap and the draft here for a year. But pretty much like what every GM of the Raiders has had to do for the last 20 years is come in and clean up the mess of the previous GM and then get forced into doing stupid spending anyways going forward. That's what a new GM would have to do here, and I think a new head coach, especially an offensive head coach, would be drooling at the possibility of coaching Deshaun Watson. I do.
That's what, you know what I just realized, Sean? There's going to be a bunch of CEOs who take over their companies this year, like this coming year, and what they're going to get the benefit of, like, for the rest of their lives on their resume, they're going to be able to show, like, hey, look, I just took this company, which, by the way, had just lost half its sales due to COVID, and I increased sales by 100% in year one.
I'm one of the fastest growing companies in the United States.
Yeah, which, that's what's going to happen with whoever, if you're a GM looking at coming into a bad team, that's what you think. Like, okay, there's nowhere to go but up. Yeah. I can't lose here. And I also trust in my own abilities to get it done. So I don't think that O'Brien's done so much damage that you can't get a good candidate in here.
I think also you'd look at it as a coach and go, this is not a team that cycles through coaches quickly. You know what I mean? Like, Dom Capers coached for 4 years, but he was 2-14 after 4 years. He deserved to be fired. Gary Kubiak got 8 years. Bill O'Brien is getting his seventh season. And those are two guys who had the vultures circling above them for at least 2 or 3 years at a time. So this is a family that runs this team. You know, granted, it's not Bob McNair, it's Cal McNair and Janice McNair, but this is a family that has generally been pretty patient with head coaches.
I think, like, if you look at, I'll take two situations. Since you just mentioned the vultures have been circling for 7 years with Bill O'Brien, I think the first guy, you know, that I started making comparisons to a few years ago, and it just keeps getting better and better every year, is Marvin Lewis
right.
with the Bengals.
Yep.
Marvin Lewis, who is in a much tougher division than the Texans, even though the AFC South isn't as bad as it used to be, the AFC North is a hard division to win. Marvin Lewis, though, just never progressed. He never won a playoff game. But he won football games. He had a respectable record every year. I would say that when Zach Taylor took that job, the Bengals are not known as a great organization, but I got to think Zach Taylor feels like, yeah, but they're going to give me as much time as I need.
Right.
They just held on to Marvin Lewis forever. People will feel the same way about the Texans' job, except that it's also considered a much, much better organization than the Bengals.
Yep.
And I know some people don't want to hear that because unless you're the Patriots, then you suck. The Texans are widely regarded around the NFL as like a solid organization, and they might have disagreements with the way they do certain things, but there's only a few teams where you look at it and you're like, jeez, what the hell? Like the Lions, the Bengals, some of those teams where it just doesn't – they can't tell their ass from their own hand.
Yeah, yeah, and then the Texans
I don't think that's an expression, I'm not sure that makes any sense, but yeah.
Yeah, it's their ass from their elbow, I think.
They don't know your ass from my hand.
Let's do headlines.
They don't know their
– Payne and Pendergast with today's headlines.
Before Seth gets to body parts that are really going to get us in trouble, let's do headlines. The Astros, they
don't know a shaft from a what? Yeah, let's go.
Okay, yeah, see, and even so, the Astros last night, they were in Seattle, and they won a baseball game. And if they win a baseball game this afternoon, late afternoon start at 5:40, the Astros will clinch a playoff spot for the fourth straight year, albeit this year in a year where they needed the rules to be changed in order to clinch a playoff spot. Who cares? The rules are the rules. They're going to make the postseason. They beat the Mariners last night 6-1. Framber Valdez, look, Seth, if we're going to debate who should be starting a playoff game for this baseball team, Framber Valdez put a pretty nice piece of business on the field last night. 7 innings pitched, one run given up. He gets his fifth win of the year to lead the staff. Framber Valdez, the first 5-game winner on the staff in the COVID season.
You know why I'm there's part of Framber where I just still have it pulled back a little bit because I want to be sure it's for real, and it's partly based on the Josh James scenario. So even though Framber has accomplished much more as a starter than Josh James ever did, he's got an interesting and unique story to how he came by his improvement. Remember Josh James? It was that he discovered his sleep apnea. And then all of a sudden discovered this velocity, and you think, like, holy crap, is this for real? And the answer was, it was kind of for real, and maybe it's not kind of for real. With Framber, a big part of his transformation has been that he's just more mature. His attitude, his ability to work through issues and everything, his approach at the mound is just way more mature. And he made this transformation in just one offseason when he visited a psychologist in the DR. And I can't say enough, like, for some guys, it really is amazing how much just a shift in attitude can do, and that it actually really, like, sports, if you see a good sports psychologist, it really, really makes a difference. It's just there are a lot of hooligans and frauds out there, too. You got to find a good one.
He might be a guy, Seth, as we sit here, we're almost done with this shortened season. And we sit here, and inevitably, we'll reach a point where we're going to be comparing Dusty Baker to A.J. Hinch. Once we've got a bigger body of work, once we've gotten through a postseason with Dusty Baker, and maybe some of those comparisons are going to be unfair because Dusty's managing with one hand tied behind his back right now with no Verlander and some of the other things that have happened. Inevitably, when we compare these two, there are going to be a lot of boxes that A.J. Hinch checks that Dusty Baker does not check. But if Framber Valdez winds up being a guy who can be a fixture in the starting rotation, that might be something that, works in Dusty's favor. You know what I mean? Where some guys' managerial styles just work better for some players than others do. You know, where A.J. Hinch's managerial style, which is probably more analytically driven and maybe just a different personality than Dusty Baker, who's maybe more old school, maybe has more anecdotal experience for Fromber to play off of. And the reason I bring that up is Fromber Valdez, Dusty told a story after Fromber's first start of the year where he wasn't very good, where he conveyed a Fernando Valenzuela story to Fromber Valdez. And that was one of Dusty's old teammates. And boy, if you watch Fromber pitch, he physically, he delivers the ball. He's got a body type. He looks a lot like Fernando Valenzuela. He's been money since then.
He steps off the mound like in the same way as Fernando Valenzuela, which he got from Dusty Baker. And that was a challenge for Fromber Valdez this offseason. It wasn't about pitch selection. It wasn't about spin rate. I mean, you're always working on that stuff, but it was more on his mental game. That's what he said. I worked 90% on my mental game as compared to my physical game to be able to focus better, to have better body language towards people and on the mound during the game. And Credit to Dusty Baker for recognizing that was the challenge for Fromber Valdez this year. And now, in credit to Valdez, he was working on that on his own, but Dusty continued the work when he got back here. As opposed to like a guy like that in that situation, he could have been a 180. You know, when a guy's attitude and his mental state or his mental approach is the really key issue, the wrong manager can destroy that. Yeah. The wrong manager just can completely crush that guy, and Dusty did the opposite.
The Astros are going to be the sixth seed in the postseason. For those who don't know how the postseason is going to work, there's going to be eight teams from each league in the postseason. The division winners are seeds 1, 2, and 3 in order of winning percentage. The seeds 4, 5, and 6 are going to be the second place teams, regardless of winning percentage, and then 7 and 8 will be the two teams with the next best records. In all likelihood, and not in all likelihood, it's been clinched basically. The team 7 and 8 in the American League are going to have better records than the Astros. It's a little strange. So they are going to be the sixth seed, Seth, because they are going to be the worst of the 3 second-place teams in the American League, which means in all likelihood they're going to play either the A's, who are the 2 seed right now, or the White Sox, who are the 3 seed right now, if the season were to end today. The A's they're obviously very familiar with because they played them 10 times this year and they play them 19 times in a normal season. It has not gone well against the A's this year. That's a really good baseball team. The White Sox, they've played not at all this year, and the White Sox are a better team this year than they've been in previous seasons. And oh, by the way, Dallas Keuchel is one of their best starters on that team. Would you rather face the A's or the White Sox in a 3-game best 2 out of 3 series if you're the Astros?
Do I want familiarity or do I want the randomness of I want to see the White Sox.
I think I do too.
Yeah,
I think they know Keuchel a little bit from his time here. I think the Astros have enough pitchers on the staff where I'd rather the opponent not see them already. They got a lot of rookies on this staff. I'd rather they had not seen some of those pitchers already.
Of how they're going to match up to Keuchel, where like the Astros are making contact but not hard contact. That plays right into Keuchel's hands. You know, you turn in a ground ball pitcher into a supreme ground ball pitcher.
Yeah. Look, the bottom line, they're just I don't want to get too nuanced about how they hit. They're not hitting right now is the problem. Like they're going to, I don't care who the pitcher is. They're just going to need to hit better. You know what I mean? Like forget that. They're hitting these ground balls or it's playing. The Astros are going to need to be much better than they've been recently, or it doesn't matter what type of balls they're hitting, you know.
But they're making contact, Sean. That's what we've been hanging our. Hey, look, they're making contact. They're making great contact. All you got to do is just get that up in the air a little bit higher and faster, buddy. That's like when you're a sales manager, do you have any salespeople that would come to you and be like, "Look, Sean, I know I'm not making any sales, but look at all the calls I've made.
Oh yeah,
look, I called like 400 people.
Oh yeah, I'm
putting in the work.
I'm doing.
Do I get
look
credit
at the pipe,
for that.
The pipeline's getting ready to burst 100%. Like, are you kidding me? Yes. The Astros are a bunch of salespeople that are missing their forecasts right now is what they are. So that's the Astros. 5:40 today, first pitch, last game against Seattle. They'll finish up the season with a 4-game set in Arlington against the Rangers. Next headline, Seth, guess who's back in the National Football League? Blake Bortles.
Oh, I thought you were going to talk about Devontae Freeman. Okay,
he is
Blake
too.
Bortles.
Yeah,
Devontae
Freeman's a New York Giant, but Blake Bortles is the funnier one of these two. He's a Denver Bronco because Drew Locke is on the injured reserve list with a shoulder injury. Their starter is going to be Jeff Driscoll. Boy, how does it feel to be a Bronco fan? You think it feels futile being a Texan fan right now? At least the Texans, knock on wood, have remained relatively healthy. If you're a Bronco fan, you went into this season maybe with a little pep in your step. Hey, we got a young quarterback who had a pretty good record down the stretch last year. You lose your quarterback. They lose Cortland Sutton to an ACL. They lose their best player, Von Miller, to a leg injury in the preseason. And now your two quarterbacks are Jeff Driskel and Blake Bortles. Life comes at you pretty fast, Seth Payne.
Boy, you know, the Vic Fangio is perhaps not the best personality for making it through a scenario like this in the eyes of the public and in the eyes of Broncos fans. I worry about how well he'll weather the storm if things don't go well for two straight seasons, because he's got that. He's not a whole lot of fluff at all. You know, he's got a very dry sense of humor, and I think that people like that and find it charming at first because he kind of breaks the mold. He doesn't seem like a sales slick salesman type or anything. But I think if they're going through adversity, I could see a fan base very much turning on them very quickly.
Okay, this goes back to something you and I were talking about earlier in this segment before headlines, and that's hiring a new head coach. Seth, in some ways, we really need to keep an eye on Cliff Kingsbury's success in Arizona this year. Because if Cliff Kingsbury, if this 2-0 start turns into them getting to the playoffs, winning 10 or 11 games, and most importantly, the offense operating at a very high level throughout the year, then the same way that Sean McVay and anybody who Sean McVay sneezed on 2 years ago wound up getting a job or at least getting considered for a job, then anybody who is an air raid, high octane, maybe even a spread offense, college offense type head coach, there are going to be fan bases clamoring for that type of head coach, and Denver would be one of those teams. If Denver doesn't weather this storm, they go 5-11 this year. You got Vic Fangio, who's an old school defensive guy, and you've got a young quarterback in Drew Locke that's heading into his third year. It's going to be a very, and they're not firing John Elway, obviously. It's going to be a very sellable solution to the fan base to fire Vic Fangio and bring in Lincoln Riley, bring in Urban Meyer to be the coach for Drew Locke and this offense once they get through all these injuries.
You know what's interesting is these RPOs, you know, become more pervasive in the NFL, the run-pass option. I was talking to John Harris about it this weekend before the game, and I said, you know, John, are colleges still way more advanced in terms of what they're doing with their RPOs? And he said they are. You know, because they've had more time doing it. Part of it, too, is that it's just easier to find mismatches in college. Like, there's some stuff you can do in the college option game that, frankly, is never going to work in the NFL. But just in college, you're doing it against inferior athletes. The offensive linemen are allowed 5 yards downfield because they don't enforce the offensive linemen downfield. So you can do cooler, scarier stuff. But I'll say that the NFL still isn't doing everything they could in the RPO games. I think some of these college kids coming into the league are actually held back by their offensive coordinators. Maybe Deshaun is one of them, because those offensive coordinators won't fully adopt or even fully understand a lot of the college option games. So, yeah, I'm way more open today to a Lincoln Riley or anybody else than I would have been 5-6 years ago. 5-6 years ago, I was the old school NFL guy that's like, nope, you can't do it that way in the NFL. That we're wrong. Yeah. We're all wrong.
Yep.
You can't do it that way in the NFL. You can't do it as much in the NFL, but you can do a lot more than a lot of these guys are doing.
Next headline, the Nuggets beat the Lakers last night, 114-106. So that series all of a sudden is interesting. The Nuggets are an Anthony Davis three-pointer away from being up 2-1 in this series. Instead, the Lakers up 2-1, but the Nuggets showing some resilience last night. This is fun. We've got a couple 2-1 series on our hands. The Celtics and the Miami Heat, game four in that series is tonight. The bigger story in the NBA may be that Adam Silver said yesterday they may not start the next season until 2021. So there literally might not be a 2020-21 season, because the next season might not start in this calendar year, because they want to have as normal a season as possible. They don't want to do a bubble again. They want to try to have an 82-game season. And they really feel like they need to have a better grasp on the coronavirus, because they're not doing this bubble again. And the bubble has the bubble has held up perfectly when it comes to the coronavirus. As we know here in Houston, the bubble has not held up perfectly when it comes to players trying to resist their appetite for the opposite sex. Hashtag Daniel House, who got kicked out of the bubble for inviting a female, I believe a COVID worker, a tester, to his hotel room at the whatever hotel it was the Rockets were staying in Disney World.
Kevin, I can attest that she was thirsty. Yeah.
Kevin Durant was on the Joe. How does he pronounce it? Is it Budden or Budden, Seth? The podcast.
Budden Schnitzel.
The Joe Budden
Schnitzel.
Podcast.
Schnitzel is how you pronounce it. Schnitzel. Budden Schnitzel.
Very popular podcast. That's definitely not Budden Schnitzel. It's a very popular podcast. Kevin Durant was a guest on it. Here's the audio. This is courtesy of TMZ. Here's the audio when Durant was asked directly about Daniel House.
Yo, what do you think about dudes trying to f*** the COVID testing girl in the bubble?
Yo, you've been in a bubble away from some action for 3 months. I mean, you can't blame him, dog.
Yeah.
I get it. That was the thing going in. Everybody was talking. That was like the first thing people were talking about. Like, yo, so they can't have no like women friends coming.
Right.
Like, yeah.
No, I heard there was no females at all outside of that. It was like the maids were all men. Like everybody was just nothing but men around. So after a couple months, you down 3-1? Nah.
You down 3-1? This shit is over with.
He said, I don't give a f- no more, man.
All right, Seth. So keep in mind that Daniel House got caught when the series was only 1-1. Was 1-1 and the Lakers having won one in a row enough for Daniel House to say, nope, need some booty?
I don't know. I want to be on that podcast with those guys. That was funny.
Well, it'd be nice if we knew how to pronounce his name first.
Three and one. it was irresponsible, but it was I can't remember. I remember they asked me on KHOU on Sports Extra every Sunday night, usually around 10:30, about, like, how would you feel? Would you accept that guy back in? I think it's like that's the most classic of all human errors that we all know and do. Like, sorry, I grew up a guy. I know a few guys that have made bad decisions with their wiener schnitzel. Right. You know, like, it's just that, yeah, it was an extreme situation. You would hope he wouldn't have done it. But I don't know. Was Daniel House, when he got into the NBA, did he know that at one point they were going to demand 3 months of celibacy out of him to get a championship? I don't know if that was a sacrifice he even signed on for. I think – so, yes, obviously I'd love to think that if I would do it, I would have stayed celibate and followed all the rules. But I also think that – I wonder if the NBA players probably started getting super agitated as they saw the NFL and the Major League Baseball bubbles start to work.
Yeah.
You know, like – MLB players, MLS players, football players, they're allowed to get all the booty they wanted away from the facility, whereas you're sitting up there trying to act like a monk, a basketball monk. It's got to be hard.
I could see that. Now, the text line is saying it's Budden.
Really hard.
But Wade Smith texted us and said it's Budden, as in Bud Light. I'm going to trust Wade Smith on this one.
It's Budden Schnitzel?
No, it's just Budden. There's no schnitzel afterwards.
Oh.
No. Stop trying to put a schnitzel on his name.
Wait, what's his name? Kevin Budden?
No, it's Joe. It's Joe Budden.
Okay.
Yeah.
Like Benjamin Button?
No, Budden.
That's it. That definitely, dude. He was definitely like a Budden Schnitzel or something, and his family cut off schnitzel at Ellis Island.
I don't know.
Or some, yeah.
I don't know. I think you probably need to watch the YouTube of the podcast. Yeah. Go watch the video.
Is he a white guy?
He's not, no.
Oh, he's not? Okay, no. Oh, geez. Well, I apologize about that. All right, it wasn't an Ellis Island thing, sorry.
All right.
Joe Budden. Who's the? Isn't there a white Budden dude that I'm thinking of?
I'm not sure, Seth. I'm not sure. Sometimes I don't know what goes on in that brain of yours. I have no idea.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with 3 rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic? And conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.